Hello, listeners, and welcome to another month of Standing Post. This is Cody Starkin bringing you another important show about the United States Secret Service. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. And for those who may have listened for a while, welcome back. This month, we have two of the first five female agents of the United States Secret Service. Pioneers in the federal law enforcement world, these ladies forged a path that would set the standard for those women who followed. We recorded a lot of audio for this show, so just like Mr. Clint Hill's interview, this will be a two-parter. Standing Post also has a special treat for you. We actually have the live recording of the swearing-in ceremony of our guests at the beginning of the show. For more information about the Secret Service, or how to join, please go to www.secretservice.gov. Now, please welcome to the show former Special Agents Catherine Childers and Sue Ann Baker.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chief Rowley, women about to become special agents, this is an historic occasion. And I want to say that this stems directly from the President's policy statement early in the administration that he wanted more women in responsible government positions. In the Treasury Department, we have tried to act in fulfillment of the President's directive. I think without further ado, we will proceed with the swearing-in. Laurie Anderson, Sue Baker, Catherine Clark, Holly Huffschmidt, and Phyllis Schantz. I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion. That I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter. So help me God.
Ladies, welcome to the show. I am humbled and honored to have you both in the studio today to speak to me about your times in the Secret Service and some of the stories that you're willing to share with us today. Do you mind introducing yourselves to the listeners?
I am Sue Ann Baker, currently residing in Florida.
Hi, I'm Catherine Childers, and I live in Texas.
And so with the show, I always like to start out with just kind of getting a background.
Well, I was born in Tennessee, but I grew up in Ohio, and then moved to Washington, D.C. after college, and then from Washington transferred to L.A., and then to the Virgin Islands when I was not an agent, and then back to Oregon, and now in Florida.
I'm a Western girl. Grew up in the west of Utah and Colorado, born in Salt Lake City. Grew up in a tiny little town called Pleasant Grove, right in the heart of the Wasatch Mountains in Utah. But then eventually my family moved to Pueblo, Colorado, and I went to the University of Colorado. So I really have Colorado blood pumping through my veins, and left Colorado looking for adventure and ended up in Washington with a case of Potomac fever, which I've been asked to explain what that meant, and eventually married a Texan and moved back and have lived there for the last 40 years. But I've partly because of the Secret Service have had a life of adventure and interesting things that really kicked off right here in Washington.
And kind of what was home life for you?
Well, my father was a wonderful older gentleman. I had parents my mother was 40 when I was born, and in 1947 when I was born, that was quite aggressive. Women didn't have children at 40, and they had an afterthought child with me and really didn't know what to do with me. That's kind of been my case a long time in life, but my father was interested in teaching me things that girls didn't usually know about or how to do. And we had a little acreage in this little town of Pleasant Grove, and Daddy found a horse for me, an old horse named Roxy, and I had a Cocker Spaniel now, but I had a Border Collie named Tippy, and I wanted to grow up and be Annie Oakley. In those days, there just weren't many mentors for little girls as to what you could do to do something important, to have an exciting life. So I wanted to be Annie Oakley. So growing up in this little rural community in the heart of Utah was perfect. We were at the foot of a great mountain called Mount Timpanogos, and I have a story for you when you're ready for it about how my father taught me how to shoot cans off a post, and that's where my adventure began, and he was a great dad. My mother was also a wonderful mother who wanted me to learn to play the violin and do the traditional things and find a husband. But I had a good cross factor, an older sister and brother who were very caring. But I was pretty much on my own and trying to figure out what you did in 1947 that wasn't on the plate.
And so how did you learn about Annie Oakley? How did you find out about her?
You know, Annie Oakley was just about the only, wouldn't you say, Sue Ann? She was out there as this remarkable young woman who was a long shooter for the Wild West show, the Buffalo Bill Wild West show. And growing up in the West, I heard about her because it was rare to see a woman performing on with the Native Americans in the show. And her key was that she was this remarkable shooter who learned up from a poor family in, I think, where you're part of the world, Tennessee. Or she'd grown up in a small rural community, but actually saved her family by shooting birds and whatever to sell. They were poverty-stricken, and she became a celebrity in the rodeo world. Okay. So I heard about her, and I just had never heard of anybody who did anything like that. Everyone I knew either were teachers or mothers, or there just weren't very many options. Were there for you, Sue Ann, as a little girl, as to what you wanted to do?
Well, everything I wanted to do was, I mean, my father told me I could do anything I wanted to do, but every time I came up with something I wanted to do, he said, oh, I'm sorry, little girls don't do that. I wanted to be a boxer. I wanted to play football. I wanted to be a police officer or preacher or anything that, I don't know why, but I wanted to do stuff that women weren't doing, even as a little girl. My role model was Wonder Woman, or Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, because I was a tomboy and I grew up in Perry, Ohio, which was a population of about 900 and still is, I think, and was right on the shores of Lake Erie. So I played by myself, or I had one other friend that was like a quarter of a mile down the road, and we would play in the trees. And so Wonder Woman and Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, that was about the only role models that I could find, because there were not many. Florence Nightingale, I suppose, if you wanted to be a nurse, but I didn't. So,
in your own time, did you find ways to be able to imagine or be able to be those people without having any type of individuals kind of telling you no or not, you can't be that way?
I mean, my first memory of wanting to be Annie Oakley was when I was 8. Mm-hmm. And I told my dad that I had all these shiny pieces. I had the cowgirl jacket, and I rode my horse, and I did all, but I didn't know how to shoot the long gun. I didn't know how to shoot the old .22, and I asked him if he would teach me how to shoot it. And at 8, that was pretty young. In fact, most kids didn't learn to shoot cans off a post at that point, but one particular afternoon, he grabbed a can out of the trash, as I recall, and ripped off the label and went into a closet where they kept the guns that had that smell of powder and old oil, the cleaning, whatever, and I'd never even seen it up close. And he said, come on, you really want to learn to shoot the gun? I said, yes, I really do. And we kind of kicked the can down the road, and he put the can on the post and brought it back and put it in my shoulder. And he said, okay, now squeeze, you know, as daddies do, squeeze it into the shoulder and breathe in and breathe out. And all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, but as it got harder and heavier, the tears began to flow down my cheeks, and wiped them off. And he said, took the gun back, and he said, that's okay. He said, it's all right. You're young. You're little. You've got plenty of time. And he said, you're just a girl. And I remember the ringing of that. You're just a girl. And he said, but if you really, and I said, no, it's not any of that. I said, I'm just scared. And I remember those words, that little girl word, because girls use that a lot. Girls were scared to do a lot of things boys did, and that was where the line in the sand was drawn, and you didn't go any further. And he said, you know what? You're just going to have to do a lot of things in your life by just doing it scared. So do you want to do it? I said, yes, I want to be Annie Oakley. And he said, then just do it scared. And that was a mantra that I've carried with me through most of the things that I've done that most women are scared to do, because I picked it up and I snugged it, and you know the first feeling, you know, and squeezed it off and bang. I usually do the bang bigger, but I'm trying to be nice to the audio guy here. That can flew in the sky, and I was enthralled with the idea of doing something that not only most little girls, but that most people never had a chance to do, which was a physical thing, an athletic thing, that was not available. Sports weren't available for our generation. Title IX hadn't come in. There were no tennis teams. There were no athletes. You were a tomboy.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Title IX? What is...
Title IX was governmental rulings. Sue Ann and I were talking about it last night, that basically said if a university had, let's say, a tennis team that was funded by federal funding, they had to offer the same opportunities to young women. Prior to that, there were no tennis teams in my high school, no tennis team, no volleyball team, no basketball team, nothing. Strangely enough, my little high school in Pueblo, Colorado, had a rifle team. Hmm. And that changed my life because it was an athletic or sport event that I could do as a woman. And there just weren't any others. But when Title IX came in, those opportunities started to become more often. But I was going to say that, you know, Sue Ann said she was a tomboy. Well, now you'd be considered an Olympic hopeful. You know, they called us tomboys, but the reality was we had athletic skills. We could compete. We could play tennis. We could shoot. We could ski. In the West, those were my sports. And from that day that I finally shot the can off the post and saw that I had some athletic skills, it changed my direction. It's probably why I ended up of interest in going to Washington. Not the Secret Service, but I think later when that opportunity came up, the fact that I had collected those skills from a little girl of being athletic and being able to shoot a gun were why I was maybe one of the five that were selected.
Suhan, do you have any?
Well, I think it's interesting that we probably had fathers that were similar, because my dad was always, today would be considered teaching STEM. I mean, he was all about science and well, there was no technology at the time, but, and living on the shores of Lake Erie, he would throw a can in the lake and hand me a .22 rifle, and I learned to shoot with an open sight at the cans that are bobbing around in Lake Erie. So we were both raised with fathers that were at least treating us more like tomboys or males as opposed to just us playing with dolls. I didn't even play with dolls. Didn't like them.
But with no intent of training us for a career.
No.
That certainly wasn't even on the forefront whatsoever. There was nothing women could do if we jumped forward having grown up in the West. Now, the other girls, Phyllis grew up in Washington. Phyllis Chance,
okay.
One of the five. I don't know where Lori grew up. But I don't know that all of us were as rural, perhaps, as Sue Ann and I were. But the opportunities were so rare. Once you graduated from high school, the opportunities were teaching, which was a valiant opportunity, there's no question about it, but was predictable, or being a secretary. And the most important skill you brought, in my case, the fact that I could shoot a can off a post and later was one of the top competitive women rifle shooters in Colorado, in Pueblo, was how fast you could type. Mm-hmm. And if you... I don't even know if that's even the application now. They go, what is your typing word speed? The words per minute. So you'd have to sit there and type, and they'd have a stopwatch to see how, and then they'd count mistakes, goodness sakes. And I laugh to say that we all took typing in high school. Sue Ann, do you remember this, that we had these big clunky typewriters, and the words that, and it was ironic, the words were, now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of their countries.
No.
Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid. There was no opportunity in even the typing lesson to say that women could come to the aid of their countries because the opportunities weren't there.
Well, and it's true. And one of the reasons that I ended up joining first the Metropolitan Police Department here in Washington, D.C. was because I was hunting for a job, and every job I applied for, they wanted to give me a typing test. It didn't matter that I had a college degree or that the position I was applying for did not require typing. And I was a really fast typist, but it really upset me that I would have to take a typing test for every job that I applied for, except in law enforcement.
You eventually end up in Washington, D.C. from your hometowns. Can you kind of both explain that process? Because you're kind of searching out for, you're explaining these typing tests and things like that, but it's kind of leading you, you were finding that that wasn't suitable.
Well, for me, I graduated from Ohio University and somehow met a gentleman that worked for University of Maryland, and he offered me a job in the adult education division as a conference coordinator. And it was for a graduate student. So I had started with the American University so I could be fulfill those requirements, but I was working at University of Maryland. That brought me to Washington, D.C. At that time, actually, I ran into one big group of police officers from Cleveland, Ohio, and they were really upset with the changes going on. And so they were at University of Maryland dealing with change. And two or three of them said to me, you should consider being a policewoman. And I think that's what planted the idea in my mind. I moved from that position after about 6 months, worked for a headhunter for a while, trying to get people to switch jobs, male engineers. We never went after the females, if there were any. And then after that, I decided I wanted to do something else, but I didn't know what. And I ended up actually living with a policewoman, Susan Roberts, and she worked for the Metropolitan Police Department and said, why don't you come and be a police officer? And so that was how I got to Washington, D.C., and how I joined the police department, which then led to the opportunity to become an agent.
Did you find that D.C. was a little bit more open to accepting women within the ranks?
Well, nobody was okay with it, okay. I don't think. I mean, the women had, at that time, with the Metropolitan Police Department, always had to have college degrees. The men did not. They always put, almost always, put the women in the youth division because women and kids go together. And it was a rare, rare thing that my roommate had gotten a job in the sex squad, and not many people did. And they didn't wear uniforms. There were no women on the street in patrol cars at that time.
Okay.
So we just wore dresses.
Well, I'd go back even a little bit back to high school in that I did have a remarkable mentor. This old woman, my age now, but old woman, had started this girls' rifle team because she felt like women needed athletic women. And I was a skier. I was one of the first women on the National Ski Patrol. I've had a lot of fun of being first because I was there. And there were so few women doing those kinds of things. But she trained me to be a really good shot. And she said, you have gumption, Catherine. If you wanted to do something with this, you could. And I can remember thinking there was a big sign behind the range where we shot, and it said a winner never quits and a quitter never wins. And there was a lot of competition and a lot of patriotism involved of well, not patriotism, but giving strength to being a winner. And when I graduated and went to college, my parents, winning to them was for me to find a husband. In 1969, when I graduated, if you hadn't found a husband in college, there were slim pickings as to what you would do. And even rolling back then to 1963 when I was in high school, anyone will tell you in November of 1963 when President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, that that changed our lives. We saw violence for the first time. We saw our whole community that had been so relatively calm and going forward to go to the moon. That was the issue. And then John Kennedy died. And I remember sitting that morning after reruns where they showed this man in a dark suit leap on the back of a limousine to and we didn't know what he was doing, but Mrs. Kennedy had left the limousine. We all know the Zapruder film, but had pushed her back in. And I remember asking a friend, this is in high school, who is that man? And why was he there? And how is he doing that? Because the entire country and the entire world was in chaos, wondering how this had happened and how Mrs. Kennedy was saved and what would happen with us in the rest of our lives. And then followed, when I was in college, with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the opposition to the Vietnam War. And yet I really genuinely had, when I didn't find a husband and I was looking for an option, I didn't look to the Secret Service. Military was not an option. You couldn't go to a graduate program in military affairs. Military didn't take women. There really wasn't any option to serve. And I had a woman, and I say this to women that may be listening to this, when you get a chance to make a call to help another young woman or a young man, as far as that's concerned, the dean of women at the University of Colorado, where I was majoring in elementary education, picked up the phone and called the congressman. Because I told her, I said, Dean Parrish, I want to do something. I want to be part of something. I want to do something important. And she said, well, Washington is where you should probably go, because the streets were filled with protest. The opportunities were slim, but things were happening, and the world was changing. And she called this congressman. She called the congressman and said, Don, knew him by his first name, I have a young woman here who I think would be a good staffer for you. She's got gumption. She's got chutzpah, and she wants to come to Washington. And his first answer was, can she type? Well, I learned that I had admitted I could type, and I was a darn good typist, and I just knew that wouldn't be the end of it. But that's how I got my first job, was typing for a congressman on Capitol Hill.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh at that. It just seems to be a common theme both your stories.
It's a theme. It's a creative theme. And while I was working for him, a young woman said to me, and again, so much of our trails followed knowing someone, hearing someone, having someone giving you a leg up. This woman said over lunch, she said, you won't believe this, but they're hiring female bodyguards for Tricia Nixon. I said, really? She said, yes. I said, bodyguards? She said, you know, like Clint Hill, the man who saved Jackie Kennedy. I said, oh, that man. And she said, yes. And I said, well, what is, I didn't even know what it was. She said, it's called the Secret Service, and they're looking for women. And she said, but I'd be afraid to do that. She said, you'd have to know how to shoot a gun, and I'd be scared. I said, I wouldn't, and I know how to shoot a gun. And that's when I took the leap and applied, and my interview at one point was with that man that I'd said, who is that man, and why is he there, and why is he doing that as a young high school girl? And he was the man who interviewed me.
Wow. It's fascinating, like how the process and how people's lives get to that point and where they can, you know, where they end up, as far as with both you ladies in the Secret Service and doing that. Sue Ann, did you have you were with the MPD? Mm-hmm. How did you hear about the Secret Service, and how did you finally apply?
At the time that I was with MPD, we went through rookie schools along with White House police officers. And I ran into one of them in the street while I was working for the police department. And there was always this friendly competition. And he said, why don't you come over and work at the White House with me? And I said, well, why don't you come and be a cop in the street? And you know they don't hire women. And he said, no, they're trying to get some positions approved. Here's the captain's name and his number. And call him, and then you'll be at the first of the line and to be interviewed. So I did, and I went in to be interviewed, but that's how I learned about it, was through another fellow law enforcement person. At that time, it was called the Executive Protective Service, or EPS, and those were the uniform division of the Secret Service. And so that's how all of us were first hired, was through the Executive Protective Service.
And we were a diverse bunch. I had no police experience whatsoever. I was a staffer from Capitol Hill. I did have the athletic ability, and I was a really good shot. I would probably say it was one of the better shots, but that's for another discussion. But the other four, and originally there were five. One woman dropped out because she married, and another woman, we call her our faithful sixth. She finished a teaching experience, Denise Ferenz, and we love her dearly, but she's not part of that so-called core group because she chose to finish some teaching experience for a year. But it was remarkable how diverse we were. And it was also remarkable how empty the playing field. Even when they decided, after that interview I had with Mr. Hill, I remember he explained that they protected the president, the vice president, all those things. And then he said it very humbly, he said, you would be willing, our agents are willing to die for the person they protect. Would you be willing to die for the person you protect? And I can remember never being more frightened in my life, scared to death, to say, yes, I would be flattered and honored to serve. But I remember thinking, so you give that up and you move forward. That was just something that was part of, if you're going to protect someone's life, whether you're a parent reaching for a kid that's just fallen into a street or whatever, you make a personal commitment. And I think all these women, these five women, had that kind of personality that had it been that they were selected for the first women in the Tomcat fighter pilot group or the first woman to be at the Air Force Academy or the military academies or whatever. They had to be of good stuff. I think the Secret Service is now saying things, do you have the right stuff? Is that it? Do you have the right makeup to be willing to do that? I remember after we had all that training, another mentor of ours, all of us, was an agent, Jerry Parr. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking him when we were protecting foreign women mostly, okay, you've taught us how to shoot. We do jiu-jitsu. We do all this training. I said, so what's the rest of it? And he said, keep them alive. Keep them happy. Keep them from. Now, this was when I was protecting the Kennedy children, John and Caroline, and I think it was Mr. Hill who said that. Keep them alive. Keep them happy. Keep them from being in discomfort, and keep them from embarrassing their mother, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and the President of the United States. And I remember thinking, my gosh, they're only 14 or 15 and 8. I don't know if that part's possible.
I want to kind of go back when they ask you if you're willing to be able to protect, even giving up your life for your protectee. Mm-hmm. Do they give you time to think about that, or is that an on-the-spot question? Is that something that are you allowed to have, or it has to be an instantaneous?
I don't remember having to think about it, and I don't remember being given any time to think about it. It was just a question. You're in an interview in the White House with suits sitting in front of you, and I remember that they said that the interview is being taped, but I never saw a tape recorder. So I have no idea where that tape recorder microphone was or where the tape is. So I don't know. I don't remember having any time to think about it. And I often talk in speeches that, you know, like I was willing to take a bullet for $8,000 a year. And
The only reason why I ask that is because, like, for myself, I'm never going to go through that process. You know, those are usually the coachable questions you have before a job interview, mm-hmm. that if you go to someone to help you out, that question's not going to pop up. I mean, I guess maybe you're thinking about that and trying to become an agent. They're going to ask that question eventually, but I've never been in that situation, so I just wanted to ask it as far as...
I think it's the nature of it. I think when you look at what they do, if someone's listening today and is at the least bit interested, and you look at the responsibilities, if you looked at the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, there were several things that happened. It's on YouTube, of the pieces of that cadre of people that were protecting him. The one agent, Tim McCarthy, you can see him lean into fire, move into the line of fire to protect the president. Agents don't duck. And if you're not interested in that kind of position, then you really probably even then shouldn't have considered it. I found it a remarkable way to serve. And also an interesting one. I will say that to work at the White House, to work around the world, to work in places both in criminal investigation and protection, they were places I fondly, in my old age, say it was like being a mouse in the pocket of history. I wasn't supposed to be there. I wasn't supposed to be standing next to Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis or standing next to the vice president as he talked to the Queen of Spain about an Apollo 14 blastoff. I wasn't supposed to be there. I was there for a reason, but it was a remarkable place to stand. Standing in the shadow of history was, for me, a remarkable experience. But yes, I think that came along with it. I don't think you thought about it much after that. That was the name of the game. That was the job.
Well,
don't
and
you
I
think?
Yes, and I think the other thing that is important to note is that, and I don't think it's changed from when we served and today, is that politics has no bearing in terms of who you're protecting. I mean, I've protected the Russian Minister of Culture, Yekaterina Furtseva. She was the highest ranking woman in Russia at that time. I had grown up ducking under the desks because of the potential nuclear attack from the Russians. So I thought KGB agents and Russians had horns. It didn't matter. You wouldn't want her being killed or assassinated while she was in the United States. So, and even with the present politics, it doesn't matter whether they're Republican or Democrat. If you're assigned to protect somebody, you're protecting them, and you are willing to give your life for that, irregardless of whether what their politics is.
Well, thank you. I don't think in the year that I've been doing the podcast that I've really ever asked that question, because I think a lot of listeners or people that follow the Secret Service, I wouldn't say easy, but I would say it's a question that comes with the territory, as you said. And I just to ask the question one time, I appreciate you being able to answer that for me.
Well, I think being given, and even though I was there a relatively short time, being given the opportunity to protect and serve, I was just, I think you were going to ask us what felt like when they gave us that badge. I guess the local term would be blown away. I couldn't believe, and I'm not sure how we were chosen. I you know, we were five young women, 23 to 25, that somehow in our lives were brought together to be in a unique place where the playing field was absolutely barren. They didn't know really what to do with us. They weren't where to, for the first year was spent really on the job training, figuring out how it could work. I have to laugh when they sent me a, now the other women you see had been through training at Metropolitan Police Department, so they knew more about it. I had to go through training with the Executive Protective Service class, and the first letter I got was to set to report to the training. It was at the Arlington National Cemetery. They had a big gym over there.
Okay.
And that they said, bring white shorts. It said, Dear Officer Clark, you have been accepted. And I think mine was $7,300. I think they paid me less than you because you were an experienced policewoman. This is your salary. Bring white shorts, white tennis shoes, and a jock strap. They hadn't changed the letter.
So that was going to be one of my questions, is how did you, what did it feel like to receive that acceptance letter? But I guess that kind of explains it.
I turned to my mother and I said, Mother, do I have a jock strap? No. No, I didn't.
I don't remember a specific feeling when I received it. I know I waited for 6 months after all of the interviews because my references were spread all over the country, and that was not smart. So it took a long time to get the top secret clearance. So I was really chomping at the bit, and I didn't hear anything. And so I must have been really excited to get some notification, and I guess it was in the mail.
Did you receive the same notification?
I don't remember that. Okay. And I think I would have.
Well,
I
was invited to come to training.
Oh, okay.
I spent a good portion of that first year in EPS, Executive Protective Service training,
okay,
where the girls, the
we
other...
We didn't have it.
They had already had their police training.
Okay.
The only example of a policewoman I knew of was Angie Dickinson, and she was pretty cute. I remember Angie Dickinson was on Policewoman, which was the first television show, I think, that featured a policewoman.
Okay.
And I thought, well, I'm not sure how to do this, but I can learn it. And I was the only woman in the class when we took hand-to-hand combat with jiu-jitsu. And I remember, and do you remember this, Sue Ann? It was a big issue as to whether or not you could do underhand pull-ups, which were very difficult. A woman is made a little differently in that strength.
Mm-hmm.
And I always heard that the FBI, now they'll probably call in and say that's not true, but the FBI was late in coming in bringing in women because they were having trouble finding women who could do some of the physical training that they were requiring. And I think the Secret Service also was smart to look at what we brought to the circle of protection and didn't stop that because perhaps we couldn't do under now, maybe we finally did. I don't recall. But in the training factor, I found the men to be very supportive. They didn't quite, it's like the letter who sent out that letter, they didn't quite know what to do with us.
Hmm.
But, and were they happy about it? I don't know if they were particularly happy. I think the trainees were less discombobulated with it than the old fellas that just thought this is the male bastion of law enforcement, the elite of the elite, and they're going to allow women. So there was some thoughts from that standpoint. I think I get asked about that probably more nowadays than I did then, but my answer has been that I'm proud to have served in the Secret Service and that the gentlemen were in the particular hierarchy, including Clint Hill and Jerry Parr and other senior officials in the Executive Protective Service, did the best they could to give us an opportunity in a very open and uneven playing field. It was the tough thing to figure out how to do that.
What were your family and friends' reactions once you started training with the Secret Service?
I think that they were all excited. I know my parents were. I don't remember anything specifically because we're talking almost 50 years ago. But
well, the only reason why I ask is because we had talked about at the beginning of the jobs and roles of women and what they were supposed to do and what was planned, like what was expected of them. But receiving this ability to go into the Secret Service, I didn't know if that narrative had changed at that point or if that was something that continued.
Well, for me, they were already used to the fact that I was unusual because I had become a policewoman, and that was not the norm. So I'm not sure that it was a big surprise that I had become a White House police officer or executive protective service. And I just, like I said, I know that my parents were really excited because I'm sure that my mother did not want me to be a police officer. At that time, Washington, D.C. had the highest crime rate per capita of any city in the nation, which is exactly why I wanted to be a police officer. I figured if you're going to learn the job, you might as well learn it where there's a lot of crime. So from that point, I'm sure she was scared to death of me being on the streets or even being with the youth division in an office. White House sounds a lot better. So.
And so.
Can I answer that?
Absolutely.
My mother was horrified. Bless her heart. She just wanted me to find a husband and settle down. And I think as I learned later, mothers at that time were worried about daughters that they could never make a living and support themselves. And the easiest and the most traditional way was to find a husband out of college, even if you had a college degree. And that was why I was encouraged to study elementary education, because I could support a husband to go to grad school or whatever. Okay. So mother wasn't thrilled. I think my dad was kind of got a kick out of it. But the thing that was interesting is the things that opened up. For instance, when we were sworn in, in my case, they gave us a gun, a badge, a commission book, extra rounds of ammunition, the 357 Magnum, and the commission book's kind of funny. We'll talk it out. But in my case, they gave me an American Express card. Found out later not everyone got one, which troubles me a bit. But I was going to be traveling a little bit on some of the protection assignments, and I had no credit. Women in 1970 couldn't get a credit card. Mm. You didn't get piles of credit cards from American Express or Chase. It just didn't happen. If you had credit, it was in the name of your husband or your father or a brother or some fool on the street that you would grab by the neck and say, sign the application. Not really, but I had no credit. I had my father's Conoco credit card when I drove to Washington in my 1959 Volkswagen for that job, because I didn't. Getting that credit was one of the steps of giving women independence, is that as women were given for the first time in the history of federal law enforcement, the five of us were given essentially credit, opportunity, a job. And it was Richard Nixon that we really had to thank, because he changed the law that said women in federal service could carry guns. It was a turbulent time, but opportunities for women were so rare. Women were on the streets fighting for equal time and equal opportunity and equal money. They were the boots on the ground, but there were those of us who were kind of shooting some holes and cracks in that glass ceiling with these opportunities that we were having.
Because of the position you were in, did you feel do you take on the task of being able to continue that pathfinding or that forging? Like, because of the positions that you were in, do you feel like you had the responsibility of continue pushing it forward?
No, I think that was a huge thing that held us together, because we had no mentors. There were no mentoring programs, per se. I mean, our supervisors were the best mentors, and they sent us in all different directions. So it wasn't like we got together very often.
Okay.
But we all felt a tremendous sense of doing a really good job, so that we didn't embarrass ourselves or the Secret Service, and so that we could have women in the future be hired.
Well, we had to do it twice as good. I've heard Phyllis Shand
yes.
say that. We got the same job, but we couldn't make it. We couldn't screw it up. If we were going to shoot, then shoot twice as good. If you were going to figure out how to flip a guy with a jiu-jitsu move, then figure out how to do it well and don't whine. I love the line, there's no whining in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
There was no whining in the Secret Service. If they wanted you to get in a tent and figure out how to get through a tear gas example where your face was, you didn't cry, you didn't say, oh, this hurt. You just ran as fast as you could to get that stuff off your face. And I think we were tough about that. I don't realize, think that any of us thought there would be this implication, the fact that 50 years later we would be known as the first five. Mm-hmm. That never came across, but the idea was we're going to have to do this right. I found that, I'll tell you a quick story.
Sure.
I'm a funny girl. I speak a lot. I went into television after I left the Secret Service. I had my own talk show for a while. And with that said, I tell people, and kids particularly, that if you can't beat them, then figure out a way to make them laugh. And in our case, there were men who really were not thrilled about having a woman as an agent partner. Not that they refused, not that they were abusive. They just didn't think it was a very good idea. And on one particular occasion, I was making an arrest with a guy that could have been a fullback for the Dallas Cowboys. Big guy. I mean, he was tough. And he was a senior agent, and he got assigned to me in that little squad car, and we went to make an arrest. And the sound walking down the hall was filled with sounds, and Shaft was playing at the other end, and we were always taught that, you know, if you hear noise, get in there quick because the contraband, the counterfeit or whatever is going to go down the back window or the toilet or whatever, and you got to hurry. And so we're getting to the door, and he looks at me. He says, "All right, you're so tough. You break down the door," because we'd bang, 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 Secret Service, Secret Service. And no one, you could hear this shuffling coming toward the door. And I looked at him, and I mean, he outweighed me by probably 75, 80 pounds and big muscles. And I looked at him and he said, "Are you out of your mind? You break down the door and I'll shoot them. I'm a lot better shot than you are." And it diffused the moment. We both looked at, well, that was realistic. And in fact, we knocked. We didn't have to break down the door. And this old lady came to the door shuffling, going, what you want there? And she was uttering some guy's checks that she thought were free because they were in her mailbox. But the point was, I think I've always used what I learned was a sense of humor in a situation to diffuse things in my entire life. I ended up being a caregiver for my husband. He had Alzheimer's for the last 10 years. And I do give credit for the brief, I was only in the service 3 years, and then I moved because I met my husband. And the one thing that we probably would want to talk about for anyone who's thinking about this career is that it isn't just a job. They say now people, what, go 6, 7, 8 jobs in their lives. What is the time? 25 years now people can live? It's not a job, it's a lifestyle. Everything about your life has to accommodate. For women, it would be having children, it would be getting married. In those days, you didn't marry other agents. The dating was dismal, if any. My mother saw me sitting next to the Princess of Spain, next to Neil Armstrong, which I thought was historic, and all she could say was, "Daddy, she's never going to get married. She's sitting with a gun in her purse with all these important people. Call my sister and find her a husband." You know, that didn't seem to be much of an option. One time I actually had handcuffs in my purse and had a date, which was rare. And the date said, "Do you really know how to use those, or are you just showing off?" And I said, "We have to carry." We did. We had to carry them with us all the time. You had to carry your gun and all that stuff in your purse. And I said, "Yes, I can carry them." He was a smart aleck. So I whipped those cuffs out, threw them out, had him handcuffed to the chair within seconds. And everybody laughed. It was a party. And he looked at me and laughed. I didn't have the key. So I had to drive back to Wisconsin Avenue, which was about an hour drive, and come back and unlock it. And as you can imagine, he never asked me out again. So dating and personal life was totally arduous. And that's part of the issue with the service, those people who are willing. And now men, particularly for women who are in the service, my husband would never have, in those days when we married, would have moved to Washington, D.C. because I had this fabulous job. Men didn't do that. Men have become much more flexible in giving women an opportunity to work as well and take care of kids, whether it's in the military or whatever, don't you think, Sue-Ann?
Sure.
And they weren't flexible in those days.
And so what did the day look like when you did receive your badges and your commission books?
I don't remember.
I have the press release. Would you like to hear it?
Well, we can provide it. If you'd like to read an excerpt from it.
No, it's kind of funny. Okay. It's not very long.
Okay.
And the interesting thing is, yes, we had been, the four of them had come from Metropolitan Police Department, so they'd had police training. I'd been through the Executive Protective Service training. We took jiu-jitsu. We knew how to shoot 357 magnums very accurately. We did training with at our training center, which was then, I think it was it the rally? It was Beltsville, and it was at the night training, for instance, they did in the Arboretum of driving at night, and we were taught to drive the limos, and we were taught to try to make the jump that Clint Hill had made. We had all the training, and then the decision was made that we would fly up to girls from Girls Brownies to Girl Scouts. We would become agents, and on this particular day, it is kind of funny that the Washington Post reported it said, five young women took the oath of office today as special agents of the U.S. Secret Service and became the first of their sex to join the 106-year-old agency. Didn't mention anything about the training. Didn't mention that we were tough, that we were athletic, that we could shoot, we could do anything. Didn't mention that. It said customarily they would be referred to as pretty or at least attractive. Since this is true of most young women successful in their careers. They entered the room with their faces averted and were sworn in with their backs to the photographers and television cameras, and that was because they really thought we'd be used a lot in undercover work and buying counterfeit. And I was, and I think you were as well.
Yes.
They said three were brunette, one a golden blonde over here, fifth had short, frosted, dark hair. All had lithe, well-shaped figures. The women all were single. I laugh when I speak. I say, you know, there was no mention that we could have broken that reporter's pencil into little pieces and killed him with their thumbs if he were an assassin. But that was the intrigue, was that they didn't really know what to say about us. They just weren't exactly sure what we would do. And I remember the PR department said they'll do the same things the men do.